Good afternoon. The House Committee on Sustainability and Economic Development come to order. We're going to take things a little bit out of order today in order to accommodate some schedules of those who have joined us. So we'll start by opening an informational meeting on the Oregon Wireless Interoperability Network and invite Chief Johnson forward along with Lindsey Ball. If he's here. Thank you. And we made a call to Representative Riley, who I think is also interested in being here for this. So, Chief Johnson, thank you very much for joining us.
Make sure I know how this is working.
Doing fine.
Chair Reed, members of the committee, joined today by Lindsey Ball, the director of OWEN. So your pleasure, sir.
We would love for you to start and start by identifying yourself. I'm fortunate to know who you are since you're fire chief in my area, but for the record, that would help us.
Thank you, Chair Reed. Jeff Johnson, fire chief of Tualatin Valley Fire and Rescue, serving the 9 cities in the Portland Metroplex and 3 counties.
Chair Reed, members of the committee, my name is Lindsey Ball. I work for Governor Kulongoski, assigned to the OWEN project.
Chair Reed, members of the committee, I think we prepared a little slideshow. That dates me, I think, a little bit. But we prepared a PowerPoint to kind of give you an overview of where the Oregon Wireless Interoperable Network is. I am chair of the State Interoperability Executive Council, and we have been established since executive order in February 2002. The SIEC is the body today that is 50% made up of local government representatives and 50% from the state of Oregon. Our goal historically is to set policy for the OWEN project, decide on technology matters, and to create a forum in which the local government and the state of Oregon interface toward this common goal. So I think Lindsey and I will take turns kind of working our way through this presentation today. Lindsey.
Chair Reed, members of the committee, I also want to point out that with Chief Johnson's position as president of the International Association of Fire Chiefs, he is spending a lot of time back in Washington, D.C., and as chair of the Statewide Interoperable Executive Council, he knows Oregon's issues very well, and he is dealing with radio communications and broadband issues back in D.C. all of the time. So Oregon is well positioned to be able to take advantage of the network that he has created back in D.C. and here in Oregon, take full advantage of any opportunities that come along. I just want to make sure everyone recognizes what a perfect position Oregon is to take advantage of opportunities that we have as we work through this presentation. Let's go back to 9/11.
Thank you.
When the Twin Towers came down, there was a lot of discussion at that time about communications and public safety. Congressional action, state actions throughout the country ensued after that. And as a result, Oregon evaluated the communication system it possessed. We have a system that's based on 1950s technology. Today, we do look at eBay as a source for parts to keep our system going that are currently out of manufacture. And if you stop to think about how the cell phone industry and communications have evolved in the last 20 years, we haven't moved yet. And in fact, when I started working for state police, June 12, 1972, we're basically talking on the same radio system today as we were back then. As a result of House Bill 2101 that passed in 2005, the 4 state communication systems that reside in ODOT, Department of Transportation, State Police, Department of Corrections, and Department of Forestry, were to move into one holistic radio communication system. In other words, we take 4 into one. In addition to that, the legislature asked us to create interoperability. To date, as you'll see in subsequent slides, we talk on multiple radios to be able to talk to one another in public safety in Oregon. And in addition to that, we are to comply with a federal mandate where we have to go from wideband, which we are today, to narrowband by January 1, 2013. And we are still on schedule to accomplish that task. Chair or Chief?
Thank you. Additionally, within the state of Oregon and across the nation, we're dealing with this notion of getting broadband to the entire country. And I know that the legislature recently created the Oregon Broadband Advisory Council, and I sit on that as well as in my position as the chair of the SIEC. The goal there is to develop and ensure implementation of a broadband network in Oregon, to extend the broadband access to underserved and unserved areas of Oregon, and create and advocate to receive funding for the statewide deployment of the same infrastructure, and then to establish Oregon's broadband policies and coordinate their implementation. As we've discussed at the committee level, there is a relationship between the high-speed broadband networks and economic development. And what our goal should be, and I'll talk about this later in the presentation, is how we take the public safety investment we're making for the Oregon wireless interoperable network, and how do you pair that up with the efforts to get to the middle mile and the last mile on broadband, and what mechanisms exist to kind of leverage the two in a partnership that makes sense. This is a map of what we have today of the cities with high-speed data service. And I know Oregon is embarking upon a process to get a very detailed map of not just the cities and the communities, but actually geographically throughout the state, where does high-speed broadband data exist, both wireless and wired.
The map you see on the screen now is the proposed backbone network, microwave backbone network for Oregon. And as you can see, we are reaching out to a lot of rural Oregon. We need to be there. We're public safety radio communications. And we have extended an opportunity and the offer to broadband providers to share the infrastructure of the Owen network so we can reach out into rural Oregon and provide broadband services there as well as other communications. As I mentioned earlier, there was a lot of issues surrounding the 9/11. The quote from Thomas Keene, on September 11th, people died because the police officers couldn't talk to firemen. And Katrina was a reenactment of the same problem. It is really hard to believe this has not been fixed. If you'll note on this next slide, you'll see five microphones on a console in a police car. That's how we're able to talk today to other police agencies and public safety. I want you to stop to think a moment. Say I'm a state policeman and I have this type of a radio rack in my car, and I'm in pursuit of a vehicle down I-5 that's trying to elude me, and I'm exceeding 100 miles an hour in pursuit of this vehicle. And at the same time, I'm crossing from one jurisdiction into the next, calling on my public safety partners to help me, and I'm driving 100 plus. I'm trying to keep track of the suspect. I'm trying to keep track of the other traffic around me. And I look down, which microphone do I grab, which squelch button do I, or knob do I turn, which volume do I turn, etc. So it becomes quite a officer safety and public safety issue with that thought in mind. In addition to that, the proposed system of the Owen radio, it will be a one radio system in the car. So we can focus on one microphone, one volume, one squelch knob to turn. We currently have 265 sites that are in play. We have one large contract in play at this time that's signed on to the Owen project. That's Architect and Engineering. Black and Veatch is a contractor. We have 80 site action plans, and we are on schedule, and we're under budget by a little over $5 million at this time. The construction contract will be coming out. Scheduled date for that is April 2nd. The radio contract, RFP contract, has been released, and we expect people to respond to that come June. You'll see the different phases of the project, phases 1 through 4. I'll let you look at that at your pleasure. That's the schedule to have this done by January 1, 2013. Real briefly about the partnerships, and I continue to say that this is a cornerstone of this project. When the conceptual design was first brought forth, it was a state build it and own it. We revised that when I was asked by the governor to lift this project. I thought we should have partnerships with local, state partners, as well as federal and tribal governments. We've been successful in signing up over 40 partners to date, saving the state approximately $60 million. We find that they're in the same situation that we are, and the day of the dueling towers on top of a mountaintop is over. We can share infrastructure just as we would like to share infrastructure with other communication vendors in the state. An example of how partnerships work, we partnered up with Bonneville Power Administration on Walker Mountain, south of Gilcrest and north of Chemult on Highway 97. It's a 50-50 deal. They pay half of the construction costs. We pay half. We also pay half the operation and maintenance shared equally between the two entities. Eugene Water and Electric Board, very similar arrangement with them as well. Clatsop County and Wickiup Mountain we put up a match for a FEMA grant, and we have access to the Wickiup radio site rent-free. Columbia County and Clackamas Communication Sites, similar agreement with Sally Jones, the coordinator from Columbia County there. We also have leveraged some federal money. Public Safety Interoperable Communications, also known as PSIC, we pick up $12.1 million to Oregon that we share with the counties in that effort. We also have a grant, which is a Community Oriented Policing Service Grant, or COPS grant, that creates the microwave link from Portland to the Dalles to Bend back to Salem. And we also have a 4th Congressional District grant that we're sharing with the Southwest 7 counties of Oregon, who actually are the holders of that grant. But they have allowed us to set the specifications as to how that will be built out, and we will share that infrastructure with them at a savings to the state.
We're asked a lot of questions about Owen. We have been 8 years getting to the point where we're actually releasing RFPs and beginning construction of this project. So I thought I'd hit some of the ones we hear more often. First one is, when will Oregon's radio network be operational? And that is driven largely in part by the FCC's deadline to have narrowband radios by January 1st, 2012. A subset of that question is people will ask, well, what's the chance that the FCC will actually make you narrowband your public safety radios? And, of course, none of us know that. I spend a lot of time with the FCC, and they're not flinching on this. But I think the biggest indicator is when they make every mother, grandmother, and father in America buy a new TV set to go HD, to go digital, I think they'll hold the police and firefighters of this country responsible to narrowband their technology, because what they did to TV is exactly what they're doing in the public communication spectrum. So I think once they've done that, I think it is inevitable they will do it with us, and they are certainly acting that way.
Excuse me, just a second. We have a question. Representative Gilliam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Did you mean 2013, January 1?
Yeah, I apologize. Yes, 2013.
And while we're stopped, I might be the only one who doesn't know this, but could you give maybe a 30-second explanation of the narrowbanding versus widebanding?
Thank you, Chair Reed. Narrowbanding, if I were going to make a traffic analogy, narrowbanding is the width of the freeway that you're allowed to operate your radios on. And essentially what the FCC has determined, and I think rightfully so, is if you think about the speed of an internet connection, that's how fast your car travels on the freeway. The width of the freeway means you can drive faster. So what the FCC has said is our lanes are too wide, and they can put twice as much traffic on our freeway if we can take four lanes and turn it into eight, or two lanes into four. So that's what narrowbanding is, literally splitting the radio waves in half in terms of their physical width, so that they can double the amount of radio spectrum. Frankly, you can auction and put that money in the U.S. Treasury. So that's what narrowbanding is, and they've already articulated that there's another iteration of narrowbanding coming in our future. So we'll move from eight lanes to 16. So our entire plan is with that in mind, knowing that that's coming.
Thanks.
Thank you, Chair Reed. How much will it cost? Currently, the estimate is $414 million. The contingencies associated with that are the more partnerships we get, the lower that, the less that makes the state's bill for partnership. Every tower that someone builds for us or that we share in the cost, the lower that is. And of course, right now, I think we're the beneficiary of the economy in terms of construction costs. In my district, Chair Reed, we've saved about 25% on the fire stations we're building right now because the construction economy is so hungry. We're really seeing some tremendous prices. who will own and use ON? Well, the state of Oregon will own the wireless interoperable network, but it will hear and speak the language of the radios used by the sheriff's departments and the city police departments and the fire departments and ambulances in Oregon. So who will use it? The state will own it, but the locals will have emergency access to that if they overrun their radio system. They can meet other state and local responders on those channels. And then we've actually contemplated a system where if the locals don't want to replace their own system, we will entertain a subscriber model where the locals can essentially pay the state of Oregon for the right to use the state's radio system. Those rates and the infrastructure around that that thought have not been nailed down yet. And how can ON assist in the development and implementation of a broadband network is the next obvious question. You heard Director Ball talk about the network that we've placed throughout Oregon. So the question we have to put before the broadband community is, if we have this infrastructure for public safety, is there any way that we can use it or leverage that infrastructure as an investment to get broadband more cost effectively to the remaining parts of Oregon? And it's broadband very much like the ambulance industry. Where the population is where it's profitable to run an ambulance company. And where the population is, it's profitable to run a broadband network to the users. In the thin parts of the state, from a populist perspective, it isn't cost effective to stand up a tower and put up a hotspot, and the signal degrades before it reaches too many farms. When we have to be there for public safety purposes with the infrastructure, is there a partnership that can be struck? And I think that's the challenge that we lay before ourselves. And I think the biggest challenge is, how do we reach out to the broadband providers and say, we're willing to be a partner, but you know your system, and now you've got a picture of ours, how can they work together to achieve Oregon's broader goals? The FCC's national broadband plan, they're doing what we're doing in Oregon on a national scale. And as I said earlier, they want broadband access across the country, they want to make it affordable, and they want a strategy on how to achieve that. And that brings us to the D block. You will hear us talk about the Public Safety Spectrum Trust, the PSST. There are two chunks of the Public Safety Spectrum Trust, and I want you to think of that as two four-lane chunks of freeway. Right now, we have one four-lane section of that freeway allocated nationwide for public safety. We don't have a car to put on it, but we own one four-lane section. There is another four-lane section right beside that one, and both those lay right within the channels that the public safety community talks on when we use our public safety radios in the 700 band. We're asking the FCC and Congress to allocate that second four-lane chunk to public safety to build out a national public safety broadband network. The Oregon State Interoperability Executive Council at our meeting last week voted unanimously to ask the Federal Communications Commission for a waiver which would allocate 10 for sure and possibly 20 megahertz of that spectrum. And those will be the lanes on which a partnership would be struck with the broadband community. And if the private community is not interested in that, then we have plenty of uses for that for the state of Oregon and the public safety community in and of itself. To date, 15 jurisdictions across this country have asked for a waiver. It is our plan that Oregon becomes the 16th. I think we've talked a little bit about the public-private partnership.
Could we wait for questions? Or
go right ahead, I think.
And I think that might be my last slide.
Okay. Representative Richardson.
Chair. I appreciate the presentation from both of you. And Chief Johnson, I'm looking at the numbers, and I really do appreciate the fact that we're moving toward recognizing the need for broadband and utilizing a $400-plus million investment to not just provide for emergency or just make towers available for commercial use to rent space.
Right.
My question really is, what if you don't get that approval? We're still sitting there with 10 megahertz for emergency use, which is, I would assume, far greater than would normally need to be used on a day-to-day basis, unless there is, I mean, if there's a huge emergency, then of course public safety and emergency use would preempt everything else. But I guess I'm just wanting to know, especially since you are on these other committees and you're very much concerned about the broadband issue, what can we do to assure that we can have distance learning and distance medical available to the rural areas of the state.
Chair Reed, Representative Richardson, excellent question, sir. The fallback position is we take 10 megahertz and do the best we can with it in Oregon. Based on all the physics analysis I've seen on the topic, it really takes 20 to do the kind of things that you're talking about, to stream video, to do all the kind of broader applications of broadband that we'd like to have. So I think it takes 20. However, when you retask that D block from the auction path that it's on, it's basically in excess of $1 billion out of the treasury that they're intending to get from an auction. So really the issue boils down is, can the national public safety community impel Congress to see the value of allocating what would otherwise $1 billion to the treasury, allocate that spectrum to public safety? If we get that waiver here in Oregon, the full 20, then those are exactly the kind of things we hope to hear, is here's the highest and best use of that. And you were spot on in your calling out the preemption component. We envision whatever we get in Oregon to be used for public safety and broader purposes. But when we, in a radio parlance, turn on our red lights and siren, the secondary use is pull to the right and let us use the whole thing. And that ruthless preemption, as it's called, would allow us to have multiple uses for that, and maybe those secondary uses get pushed off then onto fiber optic.
Just follow up?
Please.
With this kind of investment, it's one thing to say that, you know, we're looking at that, and it's another to say that it is part of the plan as we expend this level of money to assure that we have it included in the budget somehow, so that we're not building it, and then we say, okay, now how do we do this? And then we end up having to spend a lot more money, which could have been saved had we hand and glove them as we proceed with the project.
Chair Reed, Representative Richardson, here's how we contemplate that today in our plan. First, the SIEC has moved unanimously to apply for the waiver. We'll apply for both the 10 and the 20, so we should be covered there. So I believe that we'll get at least 10 at some point. Second, the only way you're effectively going to have the SEC grant your waiver is if you have a plan and you have a logical approach laid out about how you're going to get to a system on which that would ride. Third piece you need is the FCC is going to look to whether you have the financial resources to deploy it if they give it to you. The OWIN staff has structured our RFPs in a fashion that the data system that we have contemplated for public safety today, that those can be pulled at the very last moment if necessary, and that money can be retasked to a faster and broader high-speed data plan. So in that regard, we have fully contemplated it. What we don't know is how reliable the chances are that we'll get the spectrum. Anything to add, Lindsay?
No, you nailed it. That's where we are.
Representative Bentz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for this report. It's extremely interesting. I'm just curious how much cooperation you need and how much you're getting from local communities as you work your way across the state.
Chair Reed, Representative Bentz, with respect to partnerships, we have not been turned down by one entity to partner with OWIN. The support and the outreach is tremendous. That's really, as I said many times over, that's the cornerstone of this project. And it's also been noted across the country, across the United States. People in the radio build-out profession keep asking us the question, how are you creating such partnerships? We've never seen anything like this anywhere in the nation. And I think that's vital to interoperability and also reducing the cost and service delivery of this project for people of Oregon for years to come.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just reminded of the numerous contracts I've worked on for various ranchers across all of eastern Oregon on every high mountaintop that has a radio tower on it. And are you using or intending to use those types of transmittal points, or are you using cable, or what are you using?
Chair Reed, Representative Bentz, we are using microwave backbone with radio associated with the backbone. Now, the sites that we're using depend upon how the propagation of the radio and also the connectivity of the microwave works throughout the state in a network fashion. We are on lots of private sites. We're on lots of public sites. So it's a mixed bag as to what you see, where you see our radio sites located. We try to look for the best coverage off of a radio site that we can get so that we don't have to build more sites than we have to. And so if that's a private or a public, that's what drives the selection. Now, by the same token, well, I'm not going to be held up by a company that may want to charge an exorbitant rent, so to speak. I'll give you an example. We have been currently on a private site over on the coast. We've been paying $400 a month. That site was sold about 3 months ago. The new owner now wants to charge us $4,200 a month. We're going to look for a new site. So we have to look at it from a cost benefit to the system, and that's what drives the locations.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just curious if the $400 million is enough, and the reason I ask is because the job seems to be huge, and I'm thinking that the technology must be ever-changing, and just keeping up with all of the new ideas that seem to be arising every day would seem to be a hugely expensive exercise. So it's a broadband question, but just if you could tell us, is that $400 anywhere close to enough? Is it too much? Where are you on the budget?
Chair Reed, Representative Benz, our estimate of cost, is that an estimate? But to date, I haven't seen anything that would tell us differently that we're going to be over budget or appreciably under budget. But let me explain the experience we have had with Architect and Engineering, which is the only big active contract we have. We budgeted $25 million to architect and engineer the whole system for the state of Oregon. We are currently through about 80 sites where we have architect and engineering on those sites. And our experience is now showing that we will be about $5.1 million under budget on architect and engineering alone. So in that portion of the cost, we are under budget. Now, we won't know for certain until we get the RFPs back in on the construction and radio to give you a very definite answer. But I can tell you, as Chief Johnson explained earlier, construction costs have come down. People are very competitive. They're looking for the work. And we've seen reduced costs of construction. So I'm looking at the construction portion of this to be a fair price, as well as the radio.
Chair Reed, Vice Chair Benz, if I could append that. Also, the part of this project that is most likely to change from a technological perspective, we've pushed off to the latter part of the project, and that's the RF piece. The towers and the buildings won't change. Those are, a mini-generation kind of infrastructure. The microwave, there's nothing on the horizon that would indicate that microwave technology is going to change. So we've pushed off as much as we can the RF component of that, so we're buying the most up-to-date part of it.
Representative Frederick.
Hello there. Thank you, Chair Reed. A couple of things. One is I became very familiar with the situation in Alabama and what they were trying to do, and you folks are well ahead of Alabama, and they are looking to you to see what's going on there. I have a couple of questions that are not about many of what you talked about there. My concern is this. I have heard from a number of contractors and a number of people who would love to be part of the contract for this, and they feel as though they have been left out of the loop. They feel as though they have been, in fact, a couple of them were told that there was no real need for anyone to go to them, as they are minority contractors, regarding this particular thing, regarding any sort of proposals. I am interested in finding out how many local people are actually getting a chance to be part of the construction of these 300 towers. How many local contractors are going to be able to set up the electrical systems on these towers? How many local people are actually going to be involved? I know that you have three, as I recall, three companies that are presently in the RFP process for the April contract award. Two of them are, well, one of them is definitely local. Two of them have local ties, and the third, General Dynamics, as I understand it, is not necessarily local, obviously. But I'm just curious about what kind of jobs we're going to get here in Oregon to build this system here in Oregon.
Chair Reed, Representative Frederick, there's several comments or questions that you aired there. So let me back up to the first with respect to contracting, and then we'll try to piece everything else together. Contracting. We have currently one contract that's in play, and that's architect and engineering. With respect to opportunities for subcontracts under that prime, we have reached out going to the Owami Group on January 8th with Black and Veatch to talk with them. We've also been working to get the information out on the ORPIN so that subcontractors can have an opportunity to contact the primes and become subcontractors under the prime. We've also discovered that with the construction management and general contractor RFP that's coming out later this month, as you mentioned, there are three vendors that are applying for that. They are still looking for people to subcontract under them as the prime, and they are willingly accepting people to contact them for that opportunity. Now, I suspect very strongly with a project of this size, you're going to see the prime, no matter whether they're from Oregon or outside Oregon, doing a lot of subcontracting with people in the local communities. I don't think you're going to see people in Portland or Salem traveling to Burns, Oregon, or Ontario to be a radio or electric contractor or a road builder. I just don't see that as being typical. So I think what you will see is a lot of this is going to end up in rural Oregon as a subcontracted out across the state.
May I?
Please, follow up.
The January meeting with OAMI has been described to me as being singularly upsetting to many of the people there. They did not feel as though they were given much credence in terms of their concerns. So you need to talk with OAMI again. My suggestion in that. Regarding the subcontractors, there is a question about, there is not the history of many general contractors is to say that they have reached out, we just couldn't find anyone. And the agencies then saying, well, you tried your best. We'll go with that. I think we need to take a step further than that. And I'm going to suggest that if there's a way for you to make sure that, in fact, that outreach took place and that something has come of it, would give me a great deal more, give this project a great deal more credence as far as I'm concerned. I unfortunately have seen the official outreach that was not really outreach. So if you can, I would encourage you to take a look and see if there's a way to put within the contract an effort to really show that people have actually done the work on reaching not just minority contractors, but in fact local contractors. I'm interested in having folks who are, I know some folks in Portland who would be more than willing to go to Burns and Ontario to work on projects, but they are not real happy if someone comes in from Nevada or Colorado or Connecticut to do the work. So as a suggestion, I would be very encouraged if we were to see some clear local jobs produced via this $450 million project in the state of Oregon.
Chair Reed, Representative Frederick, we have plans when these contracts come up. First of all, I said they're posted on ORPIN so that people will know who the prime contractors could be, so they can start contacting them. We're also going to be working with Lydia Muniz over at Minorities, Women, and Emerging Small Businesses on her monthly newsletter so that that information is placed there as well. We've also got, we've done some estimates of job opportunities that this project will create. We worked this through the formula that's used by the Legislative Fiscal Office, or excuse me, the Legislative Revenue Office of the legislature, using their formulas. And our estimate is that this project, for the period noted, will create over 3,000 jobs in Oregon.
What period is that that's noted?
Between now and January 2013.
Thank you.
The time of the project.
Yep.
And that in phase one, which is the western half of Oregon, that portion would generate 1,009 jobs. Phase two and three would create 1,013 jobs. And in the final part of that phase two and three, there would be 1,240 jobs created. Now, I don't think, from what I've experienced in the state, that you're going to see people travel in an interstate basis to a great degree to provide construction-type opportunities here in Oregon. I haven't seen that. I've seen a lot of people here locally that can outbid someone with a backhoe from out of state, say, or a cat that needs to build a road or something of that nature, or a local electrician can bid something cheaper than someone from out of state. So I really truly believe that we will create a lot of job opportunities for Oregonians.
Have you shared that data with the committee already, the numbers that you just mentioned?
Yes. These are the same numbers that we gave to the 2009 Legislative Committee in Ways and Means, to four different subcommittees.
If possible, could you email us that data as well?
Yes, we can.
That'd be terrific. Thank you. Representative Thatcher?
Okay, thank you. And I thank you for putting all this, what could have ended up being a lot of industrial jargon and bureaucrat ease, into real layman's terms. I appreciate that. And Lindsay, you mentioned earlier that you're under budget on the architectural lineup. Okay. So was that under budget with the original estimated cost of this project, or a revised issuance of that, or what was the original estimate on this wind project?
The original estimate on the project, if you want to go back to the very initial estimate, was $993 million. That was pared down to $665 million, and that was the price tag that was attached to it when I took the project over. We reduced that down to $414 million of general fund monies at this time. Now, we estimated the cost of architect and engineering from that reduced amount, and so we are $5.1 million under budget at this time on that aspect of the project. Now, we're going to use that savings as a contingency fund for the project, because we did not budget any contingency to this project whatsoever. And typically, you'll find 10 to 15% contingency built into a project like this. But we felt that we will use contingency as a result of our savings. That's what we've done.
Commendable. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there other questions?
I've got a quick question.
Representative Gilley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Where's Walker Mountain?
Walker Mountain is about 10 miles south of Gilcrest Crescent and about 7 miles north of Chemult, Oregon.
Okay. Thank you.
And I think he passes. He passes your test, doesn't he?
Yeah. And then one more question.
If you look at the junction of Highway 58 and Highway 97, if you look straight east, you'll see the mountain up on top. And the towers that stands there.
Regarding towers, you don't have to give me an exact number, but in the ballpark, how many towers are we talking new construction for all phases of the project?
Chair Reed, Representative Gilliam, I cannot tell you the exact number because we're still looking at some of the sites that we will be going to. With the radio RFP, and the vendors will respond to what sites would best work in their engineering too. But right now, we currently look at 307 sites as total number of sites in the Owen project. And from the original evaluation of the state's communication system, 80% of those towers and buildings needed to be replaced. So, you're looking at all but 60, roughly.
One more follow-up, Mr. Chair.
Please.
Have you ever been, this is a little bit off subject and we can talk about it another time, but I just want to quickly find out if you've been approached by anybody who would like to combine wind technology.
Is this coming with hydrogen?
No.
Okay.
I promise. No
okay.
hydrogen.
All right. Thank you.
Wind technology.
It's a joke in the committee. Sorry.
Yeah. It's not that funny, but it's an inside joke. Wind technology with the towers. Has anybody talked about that with you?
Chair Reed, Representative Gilliam, no, not specifically. But I can tell you that a real problem exists with microwave links from one site to the next.
Right.
With the construction of a wind turbine in the path of a microwave shot.
Mm.
So the blades that rotate through that microwave shot will disrupt the link, and we'll lose the signal. So we have to be very careful as to how we build our system in relation to the land use of the local communities and building wind generation sites, because it can cause a problem for our communication system.
I appreciate that, and I'll talk to you more about it. My last question is, if you could go back to that first slide, maybe the second slide, that shows the spine. Is that what we're calling it?
The backbone?
The backbone. And just tell me what the acronyms are for each of the colored dots. I'm not familiar with them.
Let me get my glasses on.
And while you're getting set, let me just take a moment to welcome Representative Riley. I wanted to apologize to him because we had talked just before I came, and I said I think we're going to take care of the Senate bill beforehand, and we switched to accommodate Chief Johnson. So apologize to Representative Riley, but he obviously has a long history with Owen. We're glad he's here to add to our discussion.
Anytime we can accommodate Chief Johnson, I'm happy to do that.
Thanks for coming, Representative Riley.
Okay, the yellow dots represent sites that are ready. Pink dots are proposed sites. Green dots are where A&E is under progress, and blue dots are what's construction management and general contract progress. And if you look at the yellow dots, those were all accomplished as a result of grants, with the exception of the northwest corner in the seven counties. We had what was called the interoperable wireless network, which was federally funded down I-5, and that started back in 2005-2006. If you'll notice, out the Columbia River over to Pendleton up on Cabbage Hill, that is all part of the Columbia River Intertribal Fisheries Enforcement Radio Network, and they received, if I recall correctly, that was a $12 million grant that they picked up, but they wanted to partner with the state of Oregon, so they built the towers to our specifications, and we operate and maintain that system, and we will take ownership in about another 3.5 years of that whole system.
And A&E is architecture and engineering?
Yes.
Okay, good. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative Benz?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. When this is done, when this is all in and complete, I see you had four agencies that are going to be combined into one. Which of those agencies will be charged with the job of keeping this thing going, or do you anticipate it will be all four simply utilizing the same system?
Currently, well, first of all, the date to when everything will be completed is January 1, 2013. That's when the system will be turned on and operable. The governance model for this still rests in state police. There's been a lot of discussion about what the state should do with governance associated with this project, and once it is up and running, how we take care of it. Do we combine, do we create a single agency? Do we create some type of a board or a commission that helps advise how it should be monitored and maintained and governed and operated? All those things have yet to be determined specifically, but currently everything rests in state police with policy direction provided by the statewide interoperable executive council.
Thank you, Mr. Please. I've watched much debate between local communities over who is in control of the 911 activities, and I'm just anticipating or hoping that that won't be what we'll see happen here, but I wonder, do you anticipate this will take the place of the 911 lines in local communities, or is this going to be a something that won't be so obviously an alternative that we won't have to face that kind of set of arguments?
Chair Reed, Representative Bence, we do not see this taking the place of the local 911 centers across the state. There are currently 54 911 dispatch centers associated with the counties around the state of Oregon. We don't have any desire to take over any of that. And what I've seen within the state agencies currently is all four state agencies recognize that this is going to take place. It was the direction of the legislature and the governor, and they're working to that end.
Thank you.
Representative Thatcher.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a follow-up to my previous question a long, long time ago. I'm trying to piece together what the funding is, how you reduced it. It started out at almost $1 billion. Now, was this general fund money, and now we're just talking in the terms of what the state contribution to this whole project is? Do you want to elaborate?
If I might, Linda.
Go ahead.
Chair Reed, Representative Thatcher, let me tell you how we got our original number and what we did to get it down, and then I think maybe Lindsay could cover where the money comes from. When Governor Kitzhaber formed the SIEC in 2002, one of our first objectives was to figure out what Oregon had. So we actually used grant money to do a resource inventory, because you got to know what you have before you know what you need to replace. So we did that. And then we asked an engineering firm that specializes in this kind of communications infrastructure to tell us, based on standard public safety criteria, what it would cost to do the system. And that's how we came up with the nearly $1 billion system. We then asked our staff, we said, okay, well, we've heard what they've said, but that's unaffordable. It doesn't pass a straight face test. We're not going to advance that. What could we do to trim the cost of it? And it's really a simple math when it comes to physics of a radio system. I can tell you how to save money or add cost. The more radio towers you have, the more it will cost you. But what radio towers bring you is they bring you signal strength, which means you can talk while you're in buildings. And radio towers bring you less black holes, where, like Hell's Canyon, where your radios don't work. So what we did is we started paring out the number of radio towers, which saved cost. It did reduce the amount of Oregon that was covered with the proposed system, but it did cut back on the cost. And the third area is each mountaintop antenna has a building at the base of it. And the more radios that are in there means the more police officers or firefighters or transportation workers that can talk simultaneously. And we start trimming back the number of simultaneous conversations that can occur, and those are known as trunks. And those are the three ways we drop the system cost: coverage, towers, and trunks.
I'm assuming that could be added back at a later date if the needs change?
That's correct. We may find, very candidly, we may find that we underbuilt the number of simultaneous conversations that we need to have. And at that point, then you just go back in and you add radios. But the expensive part, which is the towers, the buildings, the microwave hallback, and the RF component, that's all been taken care of. It's just adding capacity.
Follow up, Mr. Chair?
Please.
I'm still not clear, though, and I appreciate that. That did make it more clear as to how the costs were reduced, but the 400 and, what would you say, 17, 414 million it has been reduced to, is that the total cost of the project, or is that just the state's contribution?
Chair Reed, Representative Thatcher, that's the general fund contribution that we estimate to the cost to be. Now, to give you an example, how we got it down from 665 down to a lower number. What was in the original conceptual design was a turnkey operation. Now, by turnkey, I mean you go out and you hire a firm to come to Oregon. They take care of it all for you. You're not engaged in it. They are the ones who do the engineering. They're the ones who do the integrating. And when it's up and going, they just hand it to you and they walk away. The engineering and integrating costs associated with the project, we estimate to be in the range of $120 million. So I asked the question of the engineering staff and the radio experts that we have, and I said, how can we reduce that cost? And they said, well, if you want to be your own integrator and own engineer, you can reduce that by $120 million. And I said, I want to reduce it. And so what we've done in Oregon is we've done most of the engineering in-house. We've got people who are qualified to accomplish that. The blessing that the partnerships brought also is that as we worked this in conjunction with local governments, we were entering into a partnership with them. They wanted to make sure that the system that we were installing would work for them as well. So in the most part, they've engineered it too, right behind us. And so we've had one and two sets of eyes on the surface look at it. We also retained a consulting engineering firm to check our engineering work. And to do that, they came back and said, you're spot on. It should work without any problem. And so we've been able to reduce those costs. We put a project management office in place, hiring state employees rather than contractors at a very reduced cost. Now the project management office will function as the integrator. And the integrator in this system is the person that acts as kind of like the monitor that pulls this contractor in at a certain time and then this contractor in and then this contractor in, so that it's choreographed in a way that everything is staged 1, 2, 3, so to speak. And so that saves us a lot of money. And then lastly, instead of building multiple towers, we can partner with a county or a city, or they can partner with us, and we reduce those costs by another $60 million. So that's how we've looked at this in reducing costs. And I think we're going to be very successful at it.
Another follow-up?
I'm just still trying to figure out what the total cost of the project is. It sounds like there's things coming in from a lot of different directions. You've used partnerships with cities and counties and whatnot to, with their contributions towards engineering or whatever. Just trying to figure out what the whole globe is. That's all. Would
it be reasonable to say that the current configuration is 414?
That's just general fund, though.
I'm getting ahead of where I know anything. Go ahead.
Chair Reed, Representative Thatcher, we have no way of calculating the savings with the partners. And we don't know what savings they're generating. They haven't necessarily shared that information with us. That's inside their house.
Representative Riley?
No.
Thank you. Lindsay, if I could interrupt you, would it be fair to say that almost every one of these partners is also saving money from what they would have to spend?
Chair Reed, Representative Riley, that is correct. And I think that's what the Representative Thatcher was indicating. What is the true cost since we've got the partners?
They're
saving money, but I don't know how much they're saving, and I don't know what cost it is to them. That's their business, not mine. I don't have access to that information.
Thank you. Are there other questions? I had two that I could probably combine into one fairly quickly. Are there similar efforts in other states and any lessons that you might have learned from those efforts? And the second part would be, what else do you need from the legislature? What do we need to be considering and thinking about in our interim and perhaps in the 2011 session when we're back to continue the project?
Chair Reed, members of the committee, one, to answer your first question, we've canvassed a lot of other states early on in the project, I'm talking 2 and 3 years ago now, as to what experiences they have had. They've had good experiences, bad experiences. New York was probably the worst example of a statewide system that failed, and it is in absolute chaos yet today. A successful system, a good example would be the state of Michigan, where in 1991-93 they built a statewide system, and today it was built on an independent Michigan State Patrol basis. They were the only entity to be using that system. Today they have integrated it similar to what we are doing with partners. They have between 46 and 49,000 subscribers on that system today. They reduced the cost of a communication system dramatically by doing that. We haven't demanded that anyone enter into the Owen system. We've only done outreach with infrastructure, with partnerships. But it will be an opportunity for other subscribers at the local, federal, and tribal levels to enter into the system if they want in the future. And I suspect that's going to happen. So we can reduce those costs even further. We've seen people use hybrid systems. We have a single radio system for the state of Oregon. We are hard to compare to other states because we're very geographically diverse. The topography in Oregon, as you well know, is mountainous, to a valley floor, to a coast, to a desert. Other states don't have the same type of topography that we have. If you look at Wyoming, which is fairly flat, they have 67 sites in the state. That's all they need. We have to have more just because we have mountains and valleys. So it's hard to compare from that point of view, but I think we have done a great job in being able to reduce the costs by forming partnerships and doing more work in-house instead of contracting that out. Just to kind of give you an example, if you go look for a radio engineer today, you're going to be spending $170 an hour under contract. That's a lot of money. If we can do that work in-house, we're saving ourselves money. Now, the other part of your question, Chair Reed?
What else you might need from the legislature, what we should be considering as we get ready for the 2011 session?
Stay tuned with us. Have us come back, report to you as to what our progress is, take a look at where we are with expenditures, the phases, make sure that we have our work, that we're doing our work as we should. But most importantly, keep talking to us. Have us come in, talk with you, give presentations as we have today. That's extremely important to me because I do depend upon legislators to give me feedback so that we can provide the best product. Very similar to what Representative Frederick mentioned today about some concerns with contracting. We can do all we can to make sure that people have the opportunity to be informed about the progress with Oregon's contracting opportunities.
Thank you. Chief Johnson, anything to add?
Chair Reed, I think the next time we'll need a major lift out of the body will be when we try to figure out governance long term. And I think the magic from a local government person's perspective, here's the lift. If the system looks to the state of Oregon in terms of how it's governed, maintained, how responsive we are with our customer service issues, we're going to have trouble attracting local entities that want to supplant their own system with the state of Oregon system. It is going to require this kind of blend like we have today with the SIEC, where it's some local government and some state, because that will give local governments the confidence that their issues will be heard and the state will be responsive to their needs. While we don't have that figured out today, because we've been focused on the project, there will come a day in not too many sessions future where we're going to have to figure out what the governance looks like that will draw us subscribers, which will lower the state of Oregon's cost, and it'll save locals a lot of money as well.
Thank you very much. Really appreciate you coming. I think we will, if I have anything to say about it, take you up on your offer to come back and give us an update. I think there's a direct connection to what this committee is interested in as far as connecting the public safety aspect and the economic development potential. So we really appreciate your attention to that and look forward to talking with you again.
Chair Reed, there's one last comment I would like to make so the committee is aware of it.
Please.
The one thing that we've noted, and this is directly linked to economic stimulus, the one thing that, that I wish we were stronger in, we are partnering with communication vendors, but we're partnering with communication vendors on a site-by-site basis. And what I would like for people to be, I would encourage people to do and would like to see is that they look at Owen as a network across the state that might create more opportunity to expand into the underserved and unserved areas of this state for wireless communications. So that's a bit of a carrot that I'm throwing out to some of the vending community, because I think if we look at this as a network rather than on a site-by-site, we can both help one another more than what we have already. And if we're going to build this, we're not going to build this again in another 30 years. This is our opportunity. So the door is wide open. The invitation's there.
Appreciate that invitation. Representative Riley?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to thank Lindsay and Jeff, Chief Johnson, for this presentation. As you know, this is a very important project to me. I think it's extremely important to myself and Representative Nathanson, who's back in the back of the room. We've been working on this together for quite some time, and I'm really pleased with the progress that you've shown, being ahead of the curve I think you're doing a great job, and thank you, Mr. Chair, for inviting me. This is a very important one to me.
Appreciate that.
Thank you. Thanks for recognizing Representative Nathanson. We did check and see if she wanted to testify or be anything else. She wanted to sit in the back, I think. So
right.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you both very much. So we'll continue our intellectual thread here and get an update on the Broadband Advisory Council, then hear from Brant Wolf, and conclude our meeting with a hearing on Senate Bill 1005, just so that everybody has a sense of where we're headed here. Chris is headed up, and there's a good segue from wireless interoperability to broadband. Mr. Tamer, thank you for being here.
I didn't know if it was up today or...
Yeah.
Chair Reed, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Christopher Tamarin. I'm with the Oregon Business Development Department. And I appreciate the opportunity to be here today to participate in this informational hearing and to provide a report on the Oregon Broadband Advisory Council. I've provided written testimony for your reference. The Oregon Broadband Advisory Council and the Broadband Advisory Council Fund were created in the 2009 legislative session with the passage of House Bill 3158 to ensure the implementation of statewide broadband strategies. I've also attached a copy of House Bill 3158 enrolled for your reference. The mission of the Council is to encourage coordination and collaboration between organizations and economic sectors in the state to leverage the development and use of broadband for education, for workforce development, government and healthcare, and to promote broadband adoption by citizens and communities. The Council is also charged with reporting to the Legislative Assembly on the affordability and accessibility of broadband technology in all areas of the state and on the extent of broadband technology use in healthcare, energy management, education, and government. The Council members represent Oregon cities, counties, telecommunications service providers, tribes, educators, economic development organizations, public safety agencies, healthcare providers, e-government, and the Public Utility Commission, as well as a representative from the State of House of Representatives and the State Senate. 12 of the 14 members were appointed by the governor. One non-voting member was appointed by the Speaker of the House. That member is Chair Reed. One non-voting member was appointed by the President of the Senate. That member is Senator Ferrioli. I've also provided a list of all the Council members in my written testimony, and as you can see, the membership consists of prominent leaders from around the state that have much to contribute to the work of the Council. All meetings of the Council will comply with the Oregon Public Meetings Law. The Council held its first meeting on January 28th in Salem. All members of the Council were present or represented. The first meeting was also attended by 22 members of the public, including speakers. The statute provides that the Council shall meet at least once every 3 months. However, the Council plans to meet monthly during this organizational stage. Representative Jefferson Smith, the co-author of House Bill 3158, addressed the Council on its legislative charge. In the first meeting, Public Utility Commissioner Ray Baum was elected chair, and Joseph Fresnel, the general manager and chief executive officer of Eastern Oregon Telecom, was elected vice chair. The Council adopted a set of policies and procedures by which to conduct its work, as well adopted methods for communication and information distribution, and began to develop its work plan. A key task in the work plan for this year is the preparation of a report due by November 1st, 2010, to the Legislative Assembly on the affordability and accessibility of broadband technology in all areas of the state and the extent to which broadband technology in the state is being used, again, in telehealth, energy management, education, and government. The Council, as well as the Oregon Broadband Advisory Council Fund, are currently unfunded. As provided by House Bill 3158, the Oregon Business Development Department, on behalf of the Council, may accept contributions of funds and assistance from the U.S. government and its agencies or from any other public or private sources to aid in financing the functions of the Council. The Business Development Department is directed to provide staff or facilities to support the council, which it is doing, the Department of Administrative Services, the Public Utility Commission, and the Department of Education may provide staff or facilities to support the council. And in addition, all agencies of state government are directed to assist the council in the performance of its duties and to provide information and input as needed to the council to perform its duties. A web presence has been established for the council within the Oregon Business Development Department website to provide public access to council meeting schedules, agendas, minutes, reports, and other council information. The next scheduled meeting of the council will be on Thursday, February 25th, from 9 a.m. to 2 p.m. in the State Lands Building here in Salem. And that concludes my report, and I'll do my best to answer any questions.
Thank you very much. Any questions?
Well, I'm sorry that I missed the first meeting. I'll admit that. It was the day of a big deadline at my other job immediately preceding this month-long session. I just couldn't figure out a way to escape. But I'm curious. I know some of the discussion has been around the interaction with federal opportunities, and maybe you could give us a little more detail on that discussion.
Well, certainly, again, last year, broadband, I think, returned to the front burner as an issue of concern in state government, local government, with the passage of the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act that allocated $7.2 billion for broadband projects. I think that will be one of the areas that the council will look at in developing its work plan as to how it can facilitate bringing federal stimulus dollars to Oregon and how it might work to assist applicants to win those dollars. There were three programs created in the Recovery Act. I should say three programs funded by the Recovery Act. One was the Broadband Technology Opportunities Program, administered by the National Telecommunications Information Administration, or NTIA. And one is the Broadband Initiatives Program, administered by the U.S. Department of Agriculture, Rural Utilities Service. And the final is the State Broadband Data and Development Grant Program, which was funded by the Recovery Act, but actually created earlier. To date, I can report to you that Oregon projects have received funding from the State Broadband Data and Development Grant Program, that being a $2.1 million grant to the Oregon Public Utility Commission to conduct broadband mapping in the state, and that project is underway. And then, to date, only one other program or application has been funded, and that is for the Jervis Telephone Company in Marion County, which received approximately, I think it was $630,000 in grant and loan to build out their fiber-to-the-home infrastructure in their service territory. Awards under the grant programs and loan programs have just started being announced in December of 2009. There will be rolling announcements through the end of February for round one of the funding. There's going to be a second round of funding where applications will be received by the federal government between February 16th and March 15th. And then we'll expect to hear awards from that second round probably in a June timeframe.
Would you expect that there are lessons that the committee or the council might be learning from other states? Kind of a version of the same question I asked your predecessors at the dais. Are there things we should be doing or not doing that other states have done?
I think Oregon has been fairly progressive in its approach to developing broadband policy. This council, the Oregon Broadband Advisory Council, replaces another council that sunset at the beginning of January, the Oregon Telecommunications Coordinating Council, which was very active in making public policy and legislative recommendations. Oregon, as a state, has, again, good representation of public policy building blocks within its statutes. And as a big Western state with a relatively small population, we're in a fairly strong position with regard to our telecommunications infrastructure, which is testament to, I think, the work of state government as well as local governments, as well as an aggressive and innovative private sector deploying telecommunications infrastructure throughout the state.
Thank you. Representative Benz?
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just to follow up on the Chair's question, so are you saying then that we've done what we are supposed to have done to access these federal funds, or should we be doing more, or is it too late? I mean, have we done, we passed that point, we're just waiting, or where are we exactly?
Chair Reed and Vice Chair Benz, I think all things relating to broadband infrastructure deployment and utilization as essential infrastructure is a work in progress. So I think we're going to be continuously working on this going forward. With regard to the specific federal grant programs, we did do what we needed to do to win the $2.1 million grant for the broadband mapping. The program is geared to private sector applicants as well as public-private partnerships, and I think we're at the beginning of that process. Unfortunately, we're a year after the Recovery Act was passed, and to date, only about 7% of the $7.2 billion that were allocated for broadband projects has been awarded, and that doesn't mean dispersed or spent, just as that grants and loans have been announced. So the process has been very long and very cumbersome and very slow, and all of these funds are supposed to be expended by September 30, 2010, according to the Recovery Act, and there is a growing concern whether that's going to be possible to do. I will add to that that the Obama administration has identified broadband infrastructure as an important economic development issue in its platform, and I think we expect to see more federal attention to how we improve the broadband infrastructure throughout the country and utilization of that infrastructure throughout the country. So I don't think the stimulus funding programs are going to be the end of the process. I think we will likely see more funding programs in the future, and we'll have to wait and see how the rest of the process unfolds with the current programs.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question was, do you think we should be doing more in your department, in the Economic Development Agency, is it time past for running around and funding more things inside that department? Now we're just in the waiting mode.
Chair Reed and Vice Chair Benz, they're both federal programs. The broadband initiatives program and the BTOP broadband technology opportunities program. There is no role for the state governments in the BIP program. There is a role provided in the BTOP program. The state is able to provide recommendations of projects to NTIA, which those recommendations then become one factor in decisions made by NTIA and the award of grants. The state did perform that role. There were about 93 applications that provided services within the state of Oregon. The governor's office recommended 12 projects to NTIA. One of them was the Jervis Telephone Company that was awarded. Others are still pending. The state will have another opportunity to make recommendations on round two of the BTOP program going forward. So again, these are state programs for applicants from the private sector as well as from public and private partnerships.
Go ahead. Thank you. Okay. I'm just asking, does your department have what it needs to appropriately ask for that or participate in that process? Or do you need more help? Do you have all the, if you had a wish list, would you be adding to it, or are you just perfectly satisfied with what you've got to try to access these programs?
Chair Reed and Vice Chair Benz, accessing the programs is a real challenge, and I don't know that I would say my department alone isn't working on the project. It is working in conjunction with other departments, specifically Department of Administrative Services and the Public Utility Commission, in trying to respond as best we can to those opportunities and recommending Oregon projects to it. The governor in last year also recommended to NTIA, as it began the design of its the BTOP program, that they follow a block grant model, partnering with the states and providing a block of funds to the state to then be dispersed for projects within the state. That recommendation was made by the governor to NTIA. NTIA chose not to make that role or take that approach, but instead administer it all within the agency itself.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Any questions from Mr. Tamron? Thank you very much for coming.
Before we move on to Mr. Wolf, I know this has been a topic of some interest, so I wonder if there's anyone here who wants to say anything else about the Broadband Advisory Council. I don't see anyone. Mr. Wolf, your turn.
Chair, members of the committee, good afternoon. My name is Brant Wolf, representing the Oregon Telecommunications Association. The issue that we bring to you today is similar. It's related to what Mr. Tamron just was speaking about, not the council itself, but the issues are kind of similar. The association and the industry kind of in general has a specific request that we would like the committee to consider. And as a means of getting to that specific request, a brief overview of the Oregon Universal Service Fund is in order. The state of Oregon, it's not unique that we have a state Universal Service Fund, but not every state has one. For example, Washington does not. Oregon does. The state fund was created in 1999. It went into effect in the year 2000. And as you can see in my testimony, the purpose of the fund is to support basic telephone service throughout the state and ensure that it's available to everyone at affordable and reasonable rates. Just plain basic telephone service, that's it.
But sometimes referred to as the Aunt Bessie rate or something like that?
Aunt Bessie, there are other
terms. There are other names, I'm sure, too.
Yeah. Okay. It's plain old telephone service is the acronym, which is my favorite of all acronyms. It's plain old telephone service. So that's what the fund does. And that the fund is, there's a surcharge on every telephone bill in the state minus wireless carriers. They don't contribute to the fund. So if you still have a wireless or a wireline phone in your home, then you are contributing to the fund. And you can see the surcharge there. It's gone up and down. It's set to go down again in April. As I understand it, the surcharge generates approximately $48 million per year that is distributed back out to the companies that provide the service in rural Oregon. As Chris Tamron alluded to earlier, the federal government, through its stimulus program, its stimulus efforts, sought to map out in each state the availability of broadband services in each state, in all corners of the state. Obviously, that is kind of an expensive proposition. There was no money to do this in the general fund, so the Oregon Public Utility Commission, during the last year during the regular session, approached some of the industry and asked us if we would have any issues or heartburn with the state fund deviating from its purpose and taking some of that money out to use it for the matching piece that the PUC needed for the broadband mapping project. We kind of went back and forth on some of the language, and finally we agreed to what that language should be. I've attached to my testimony a couple of things. One is the grant process that the PUC went through, and you can just look at that if you have any questions. I can try and answer them. The other are two pages of two bills that were passed. I got to get this right here. The first bill, the language in House Bill 3158 is the language that we all agreed to. It was very explicit. The funds could be used to help pay for the broadband mapping, and that was it. What was actually adopted, in, which is found in 3199, in our opinion, is far, far too broad. And if you read it, and if you didn't know anything other than what you're reading, you could certainly make the assumption that that fund should be used to support deployment, support consumers, I mean everything as it relates to the use of broadband. We decided last session not to try and fix that at, as the session was winding down. It was important to get the money to go ahead with the mapping project. Rather, we would try to come, we would come back to the legislature to in an attempt to amend the bill back to what it should have said. And that's going to be the specific request that we have you introduce a bill, that this committee would consider introducing a bill during the interim to effect the change in the next regular session. So that is the very brief, hopefully useful overview of the State Universal Service Fund and our specific request. I'd be happy to answer any questions you might have about any of that
Thank you very much.
For that matter.
Be careful on the on that last offer. Representative Gilliam has a wide range of questions he often asks.
I'll correct myself. Anything they might know anything about.
There you go. That helps. So
doesn't make a difference.
Could you talk a little bit more about the, is there an agreed to reason for the change? You and I have had some conversation on this too, but what caused the disconnect?
Well, as to how the disconnect occurred, that's just...
Maybe that's the wrong word to use, but the discrepancy?
It, you know, as things happen at the end of a session, language is drafted. It's you know, there are communication issues maybe between legislative council and what, you know, you're requesting to have done, and that's how it happened. As to why we think it needs to change, the offending language to us is that part on House Bill 3199 that says specifically, may be used by the PUC to facilitate the availability of broadband at fair and reasonable rates throughout the state. That basically changes the entire purpose of the fund. I mean, right now, it's used to support plain old telephone service. That clearly says it can be used for an entirely different purpose, which may be appropriate at some point in the future. In fact, the industry kind of is trending that way. It needs to transition, but the transition process shouldn't be because of a mistake that occurred. There should be a process, and we're actually hopeful that we can approach the Oregon Broadband Advisory Council with some of our ideas for transitioning the fund towards supporting broadband and away from plain old telephone service.
That may well fit with the nature of the council too, as far as providing recommendations. Have you uncovered anyone who objects to this proposed change back to the original sort of purpose?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I have not. The parties to the agreement were the wireline telecommunications business and the Oregon Public Utility Commission, and those parties agree.
That's helpful. Thank you. If Sarah's in, I'm looking up and down just to see if there are any other questions.
Sure.
I don't see any. That's very helpful. I think as we move towards the 2011 session, it's certainly reasonable for the committee to consider that. I don't think we're ready to make a motion on that
front
yet today, but I do appreciate having the background. I appreciate your bringing to your attention.
Thank you. I appreciate your time.
Thanks very much. With that, we have just one more item on our agenda, so we'll close the informational meeting that covers the general topic of wireless and broadband, and open a public hearing on House Bill or Senate Bill. We've made the switch. Senate bills now. I think this may be the only Senate bill we have in our committee's possession. Oh, we have a Senate joint resolution as well, but this is the only Senate bill. So open a public hearing on Senate Bill 1005. Beth.
Mr. Chair, members of committee, Senate Bill 1005 that you have in front of you, it authorizes Housing and Community Services Department to contract to provide compliance monitoring or other administrative functions regarding housing developments and affordable housing. It declares an emergency effective upon passage, and there's no revenue impact, and a fiscal statement was issued on the bill.
Thank you. And you must be Ms. McNeil.
I am.
Please go ahead.
Chair Reed, members of the committee, my name is Marlis McNeil. I'm an administrator for the Asset Property Management Division of Oregon Housing and Community Services. For the last 9 years, Oregon Housing and Community Services has administered the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development's multifamily Section 8 contract. Under this contract, state employees provide highly technical work to ensure that apartment communities comply with all laws and rules relative to the regulatory agreements that they have signed with both the state and federal government. Oregon Housing does this work very well, and it's proven to be a very beneficial to the people across the state. Recently, HUD has been exploring some changes to its contracting for monitoring its multifamily Section 8 housing. To achieve an economy of scale, HUD has been considering putting the contract out for regional and multi-state bids in the near future. What the passage of Senate Bill 1005 will do will allow Oregon Housing and Community Services to compete for the contract if HUD pursues regional or multi-state contracting, which currently we do not have the ability to do. We have the approval through our ORSs to do state contracting only. Under federal law, only public housing authorities can bid on this particular contract. In addition, the bill would allow Oregon Housing and Community Services to contract with other affordable housing providers that lack capacity to monitor their own properties. There is no fiscal impact for this particular Senate bill, and the passage of the bill would generate no additional expenses for the department. In fact, contracting for additional monitoring may generate some revenue above the cost of providing the services. This revenue is essential for supporting underfunded activities for our department, and I know you've had a very probably long session so far, so I will stop my comments there. Be happy to answer any questions any of you may have.
Thank you very much. Are there questions? Representative Benz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I find this interesting because I have a number of clients who own this type of housing and have complained many times about the compliance monitoring, and whether that's carried out by your department or the federal folks, I have no idea. But I'm just curious how broad of a open door this would be. Is this going to, if we adopt this language, does it allow you, I see it's in-state or out-of-state.
Correct.
Does that mean you could do this type of compliance monitoring in, let's say, Washington, Vancouver? Where out-of-state would you be going?
Sure. Chair Reed, Vice Chair Bence, it would allow us to do many things. We've managed the compliance monitoring for the federal government, as I said, for the past 9 years, and it's only been in this state. And I'm not sure what clients you may be speaking of. There's several different kinds of Section 8 housing. There's voucher-based. This is particularly what they call project-based. But it would allow us to, hopefully, it's very, very important to us as a state agency, and I believe to those people that we serve in the state of Oregon, to be able to keep what we've been working on for all these years, and that's the state of Oregon. That's our prime focus, is to keep what we've had all of these years. If HUD, we expect that they're going to put a request for proposal out sometime spring of this year. They believe March. If they require us to bid not only on our state, but other states, this would allow us to do that. And if you look at the economies of scale, it doesn't make a lot of sense to go across the country to do this. But I do believe that there are some neighboring states that we may be able to do very cost effectively. And if that's what it's going to take for us to at least to be able to keep our state, who frankly I don't believe any state can monitor our properties as well as we have been able to in the past, would allow us to do that. We've got some numbers of some smaller states such as Nevada, Idaho. Quite frankly, Washington is a very big state with a lot of contracts. I'm not sure that we would be interested in doing that state, but it would allow us to do that. And it would also allow us to do some contract work for smaller agencies. For instance, housing authorities, nonprofit organizations would also allow us to do that work as well.
Thank you for that. I have to admit, having wandered through the HUD regulations, it is the most amazing swamp and morass of regulatory effort I've ever seen, truly. I'm just curious, has the federal government been paying the state to this point? I'm not quite sure of the switch. If we've been doing it, have we been receiving some sort of pay from the federal government and now we have to actually file a contract? I'm not quite sure what's changing.
Chair Reed, Representative Vance, members of the committee. Actually, this was a 9 years ago, the federal Congress mandated that HUD sub out their requirement for compliance monitoring to state agencies such as ours, frankly, because they had done such a poor job at doing so. There are over 45 contractors, most of them state housing finance agencies such as ours, that are doing this business right now throughout the United States. And it has been, quite frankly, a very lucrative income stream for our housing agency and has helped. Our Oregon Housing and Community Services has very, very, very small amount of general fund, and we generate our own income. And it's allowed us to continue to be able to do that. And it has brought approximately, depending on our cost for any given year, anywhere between $300 and $400 million annually to our agency. Obviously, we would like to continue to do that. And with the new initiatives, transparency, that type of thing, they are now just getting ready to rebid that contract that's been in existence all these years. And that's why the change.
Thank you.
I want to make sure I heard correctly something I think you said. It sounds like you're expecting that HUD may decide to require the ability to do multi-state sort of situations. Did I get that part right?
Chair Reed, that is exactly correct.
Okay. So then, but if they don't, this would also be a benefit in that you might then find a situation where you could provide that service to other states. Is that also right?
Chair Reed, members of the committee, that is correct.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Other questions? I have one more. A little game show, sort of complete this sentence here. I'm reading from your testimony. I'm thinking maybe there was something missing. The paragraph that starts, Senate Bill 1005 will allow OHCS to provide small housing authorities and other housing providers. I'm guessing there was something else to that sentence.
That lacked the capacity to monitor their own projects would allow us to do that for them.
Okay.
I apologize for that.
Problem. I don't see any. Committee, shall we proceed to a work session and help this bill along its way? It did receive a 29-0 vote in the Senate with one senator absent, so it's had some good vetting there as well and good support. I don't see any objection to that. So before we proceed, I should ask if there's anyone else who wants to be heard on this bill. We seem to have mostly cleared the room. But
I can do that. Obviously,
I don't think it was you. I think it was the committee. Okay, so seeing none, we'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 1005 and open a work session on Senate Bill 1005. Any motions?
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 1005 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you. Representative Bentz moves Senate Bill 1005 as amended to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? I don't see any. Motion carries. And we'll note that Representative Holvey and Representative Thatcher are excused. With that, the motion carries. Senate Bill 1005 goes to the floor with the pass recommendation. Representative Frederick, will you carry?
I will.
Thank you. With that, we will close the work session on Senate Bill 1005.
Thank you very much.
I believe we have managed to finish our agenda a little bit early.
That's unusual for you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much.
We try to make most efficient use of the time we have together. We wouldn't want you to
I need an insurance on behalf of representatives.